D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal. Rein in den Elfenbeinturm. Es gilt das gesprochene Wort. In Universitäten, Akademien und Forschungszentren. Die großen Köpfe der Vergangenheit. Die besten Hirne der Gegenwart.
Mit Katrin Ohlendorf. Heute Trust and Mistrust von Jan-Philipp Remzma. Misstrauen sei nicht nur das Gegenteil von Vertrauen, sondern als solches zugleich ein Äquivalent für Vertrauen, schrieb der Soziologe Niklas Luhmann. Er erklärt das mit der Funktion der beiden. Vertrauen reduziere soziale Komplexität. Und das Gleiche gelte eben für Misstrauen. Ähnlich argumentiert unser heutiger Redner, der Philologe, Mäzen und Publizist Jan-Philipp Remzma. In seinem Vortrag führt er aus, dass Misstrauen keinesfalls das Gegenteil von Vertrauen sei, sondern vielmehr Orientierungsstrategie in einer Umgebung, die als mehr oder minder vertrauenswürdig angesehen wird. Mit vielen Beispielen aus Bereichen etwa zwischenmenschlicher Verhältnisse oder der Beziehungen zwischen Menschen und Institutionen erläutert er unter anderem, dass ein Leben bei völliger Abwesenheit von Vertrauen gar nicht möglich sei oder dass Misstrauen wiederum auch Vertrauen benötige. Mit seinem Vortrag setzen wir unsere Reihe über Vertrauen fort, die wir vergangene Woche begonnen haben. Wir senden in dieser Serie Vorträge der Tagung On Trust, die das Einstein Forum Potsdam, dessen Kuratorium Remzma im Übrigen vorsitzt, am 3. und 4. November dieses Jahres veranstaltet hat. Wissenschaftler verschiedenster Fachbereiche haben sich darin dem Thema Vertrauen aus ihrem eigenen Fach- oder theoriespezifischen Blickwinkel genähert. Alle Vorträge dieser Reihe und Informationen zu den Vortragenden finden Sie natürlich wie immer bei uns im Netz unter wissen.dradio.de. Und da können Sie über die Thesen der Redner auch gerne diskutieren. Hören Sie nun Jan-Philipp Remzma mit seinem Vortrag über Misstrauen und Vertrauen. Trust and Mistrust.
Trust is a fuzzy concept, and maybe this is the only sentence in my lecture you all will agree. The first problem you face when trying to understand trust from a philosophical or sociological viewpoint is that the word is quite common in everyday language. Everyone knows that a trustworthy person is nice to know, or that someone who is too trusting might run into problems and in life and into problems with us. But on a whole, the everyday sense of trust is that it's something good. Erik Erikson mentioned before, believed that Urvertrauen, basic trust, is something that we achieve if we are lucky in childhood, and that gives us self-confidence later in life. We have heard about that. If we don't achieve this in childhood, we are left with an Urmisstrauen, a basic mistrust. Whether Erikson was right about the existence of a basic trust, or whether his concept is just a form of compensation for a basic mistrust that frames the human condition, we'll never be able to determine empirically. There's a consensus between Ann-Kathrin Scherer and me, even though she thinks it's in practice you should assume that basic trust is a gift from nature. You are better off with that assumption, and maybe your child too. I think it all depends on your prior philosophical commitments. We all have them, and none of us can escape them. Still, all of us regard trust as something good, and this holds true even for dictators. A hardcore Leninist has to trust in those who help him control those he cannot trust. So trust is good, and it somehow works. We all accept that trust is the foundation of our financial system, but we never feel quite at ease with this knowledge. Why? Because trust is one thing you can't be trusting of. Trust, it seems, requires a fundamental mistrust. If trust is a fuzzy concept, how do we make our understanding of it more precise? One way is to analyze trust in the many different ways it appears in the ordinary language and daily life. No friendship without trust, cela va sans dire. The end of trust is the end of friendship. Yes. But is friendship based on trust or only somehow on trust? I can have a close friend and say, I'd entrust him with everything, but not with the truth about X, Y, Z. You can't trust him in that. You may analyze whether the healing power of a placebo consists mostly in the relation a patient has to his doctor. The patient may believe that the placebo heals him because he thinks his doctor and his prescriptions are trustworthy. But it's been shown that expensive placebos have more healing power than cheap ones. Is it because the patient trusts the doctor? He gives me what is really good. Or does he trust the markets? The pharmaceutical industry spent more money for developing a really good drug, so they have earned their money. Or does he believe that the pharmaceutical industry is a bunch of scoundrels and switches to the lesser evil, namely to treatments leveled in a more trustful way? But will he choose a cheap drug? Maybe he will take some for free if the healer that gave it to him claims he isn't allowed to earn money from his healing powers. The patient accepts the gift, and maybe next time he drops a bit more into the beggar's hat. Does he think that the transcendental world is a market economy after all? We don't have clear answers to these questions, but can find out more by conducting field research, surveys, tests, and so on. And in the end, you may discover, say, that the blue and yellow pills have better healing effect than white ones. Indeed, they have. Personally, I would prefer white pills, and I probably wouldn't be fond of gray ones. Whatever such studies conclude, and whatever their results and theoretical reflections might be, the outcome will be that trust is everywhere. But what we exactly mean by trust differs from situation to situation. It's a fuzzy patchwork, and that is also what makes you nervous. The temptation may be to say that in the end, trust lies behind every social phenomenon. There always have been theorists who said that it's power or violence or interests combined with power, force, or violence that in the end makes society what it is or what it will be, or makes it change or keeps it together or gives its characteristic features. You want to find out the forces of innermost life that bind society, to allude to Faust Part 1? Or you might have the fantasy of digging deeper and deeper until you find the bedrock where your spade turns. That's how Wittgenstein put the scientific desire and delusion. But it seems strange to compare trust to bedrock. Maybe it's just because of the metaphor. Things that are fuzzy don't cause spades to turn. If you analyze trust as an interpersonal relation, you analyze this relation and the role that trust plays in it. It isn't necessary to define a concept of trust that covers every case. Instead, you'll find what Wittgenstein calls family resemblances, a concept I'm sure most of us are familiar with. If you analyze trust as an attitude towards social institutions, you'll discover many ways trust is expressed. To trust the train service, to trust that your train will arrive on time, say, is a different kind of trust than we trust that words and numbers written on a piece of paper mean money. And this meaning has a lot to do with the way you live your daily life. There are some sociologists who think that there is only one kind of trust, either personal or institutional. And you can somehow deduce the one from the other. I don't think this works. You don't trust the train service because you trust the crew or the managing director. And you don't trust the train service because you had some good experience with kind and competent train staff, after which you more or less unconsciously decided to trust the train service in general. And even if you insist on explaining trust in the train service like this, a similar approach would never work to to explain our trust in the monetary system. What you need in any case, though, is the experience that it works. Once you have this experience, you see the occasional failure in a different light. When things don't work, you regard it as the exception. You say, next time I read the timetable twice before planning my excursion. Or, the cashier didn't accept this banknote, but that's because it was a counterfeit. Or, Lehman Brothers may have collapsed, but the Fed won't. The truth, however, is that trust can break down. It can happen vis-à-vis people, with people you once called friends, with strangers you welcomed into your home who then robbed you, after which you mistrust each and everyone you don't know. It can also happen vis-à-vis institutions, at least vis-à-vis some institutions, as someone says, I'll never go to that hospital again. But what would it mean to say, I no longer trust the monetary system? Do you return your paychecks? Do you stop working entirely? Do you steal your food instead of buying it? The examples show that it is easy to understand sentences of the form, I don't trust in XYZ anymore, in some cases. It's quite difficult, if not impossible, to understand them in others. If an academic says that he or she doesn't trust in the stability of the cosmic order, the person is likely saying, I'm a cosmologist who wants to present a new theory, and I trust that the publication committee of science will accept my paper. When I ask the academic, what does the theory mean for your academic career? Everyone understands what I am saying. When I ask, what does that theory mean for your daily life? No one knows. This was different for the ancient Aztecs, whose doubt about the stability of the cosmic order had practical consequences. Their beliefs led them to wage war against neighboring communities and round up as many prisoners as possible to sacrifice to the gods, who, if pleased by the sacrificial offering, prevented the world from coming to an end. The difference between the Aztec way of understanding the universe and ours, when it comes to the concept of trust, turns on the respective roles of religion and science, but also on a specific relation to social practices. The Aztecs thought they had a way of influencing the stability of the cosmic order. We do not. The Aztec way of thinking about the cosmic order produced a very complex social order. Priests, kings, warriors, architects, craftsmen, artists, empire, and so on. Our way of thinking about the stability of the cosmic order also has consequences for scientific standards, for academic careers, and, in times not so long ago, for theological disputes. But it has no practical consequences that could compare to those of Aztec society. The modern or Western idea of a cosmic order shapes our knowledge of nearly everything, including technology, but I have no concept of how to influence the cosmic order itself. Even if we are religious, we do not pray in the evening that the laws of gravity continue to apply tomorrow as they did today. Our trust in the stability of the cosmic order is not so much a trust as a confidence. We are confident in things, that is the way I use the words. Many different ways to use the words trust and confidence and in different languages. Well, just this is the way I do. Maybe you choose other meanings. We are confident in things like the cosmic order because we don't know what else to do. The line between confidence and trust is fuzzy, however. Confidence is confidence in the world as such, and a kind of stability you don't have to think about. If you take a stone and drop it, you are confident it will fall downwards and not float to the sky. In Germany, people have no reason to share out their shoes in the morning. In regions with scorpions, they do. But if you do live in a region with scorpions, you can trust in your own safety, provided you take the right precautionary measures. Here, mistrust is appropriate. When you lack confidence, by contrast, you don't know when it's appropriate to be mistrustful. For us, doubt in the stability of the cosmos would completely undermine our confidence. For the Aztecs, doubt in the stability of the cosmos opened up practical strategies for securing it. The line between confidence and trust much depends on the culture you live in, and cultures change. And only this kind of change is historically or sociologically relevant. Confidence might collapse. Someone may believe that the walls of his house are melting. He may think that others can read his thoughts or influence them by radio waves. In all cases, our diagnosis will be the same. This person has a mental disorder and needs help. We think in terms of psychology or medicine. If a mental disorder is part of a collective paranoia, the help others provide will be a different sort. If someone thinks a neighbor is practicing witchcraft, and enough people in the community believe it to be true, then they will collectively accuse the neighbor of witchcraft and condemn him or her to death. This is a way of restoring public trust in the social environment. Sociological analysis can bring out the historical, psychological, and in some cases, medical significance behind society's ways of restoring trust. If someone loses confidence, he interprets his environment differently. Something is not only happening, someone is doing something to him. He has to find out what is happening and who is doing it and what to do against it. There's one mental disorder where one's own limbs are perceived to be foreign to the body. Oliver Sacks reports that a patient suffering from this condition yelled out in the morning, "They sued the leg of a dead body unto me. Cut it off, cut it off." The doctors didn't share his interpretation. They knew that something strange was happening, but they relied on the parameters they were used to and called it a neurological disorder. The patient didn't accept this view. The doctor's diagnosis was that part of the patient's brain was impairing his cognitive capacities, leading to a partial breakdown of confidence in the world. The patient's diagnosis was that he had the right to be mistrustful of the hospital and the doctors. The doctors had to find a way to comfort the patient, knowing that what he was experiencing could never, ever happen. And even if it did, it would never happen this way. The partial collapse of confidence is something you can cope with only if you are prepared to change your concept of trust. And you can do this only if you can answer the question, what to do next? Someone who suffers the partial collapse of confidence can psychologically survive only if he accepts a different concept of trust, ones that others share. The patient may take tranquilizers and afterwards listen to the doctor's perspective. Maybe he'll adopt it. Maybe he won't. But as long as he doesn't, there's no way out. This kind of confidence is a basic necessity. If you lose it, you can find something else to trust in, or you lose your mind. You have to be trustful. And you have to be mistrustful too, but I'll come to that later. There is one reason why you have to trust. You cannot be mistrustful all the way, in every place, at every moment, without going crazy. This claim is supported by Wittgenstein's writings on certainty. No one can doubt each and everything And no one can doubt purely and simply. As evidence, Wittgenstein pointed out the famous sentence with which G.E. Moore tried to prove that there is something you can really be certain of, namely, I'm sure that this is my hand. Wittgenstein said that a sentence like this makes no sense outside very particular circumstances. The patient who saw his leg as a foreign appendage might, after a successful treatment, say, now I know, this leg is really mine. Situations like that can occur, but they are not suited to serve as an epistemological or an ontological foundation. Philosophers sometimes think it makes sense to assume that there is something like doubt, pure and simple, which is why they undertake missions to identify that which admits no doubt under any circumstances. Wittgenstein, as you know, thought otherwise. In Uncertainty, he writes, I'm sitting with a philosopher in the garden. He says again and again, I know that that's a tree, pointing to a tree near us. Someone else arrives and hears this, and I tell him, this fellow isn't insane. We are only doing philosophy. Donald Davidson and Richard Rorty follow Wittgenstein and David Hume in their critique of radical skepticism. There is no thing like radical skepticism because there is no possibility of it. To be skeptical in one respect, you have to rely on quite a lot of things you and others are sure of. To doubt something in our common world, we have to make reference to our common world. If anyone tries to deny this, you're best off leaving him be, as David Hume recommended. To be mistrustful in some respects, you have to live in a universe of trust. If you think it's not a good idea to be at a certain place at midnight, you go to a place that seems safe. And when you do, you provide others with an example. Don't go here, you'd better go there. You show them a strategy to find a more trustworthy environment. You show them what to do, and you show them that you are doing it too. You trust politicians? I don't. Yes, you do. Or let me put it this way, you are working on it. You are voting because you want to change. Or you don't go voting, and by doing so, you strengthen the so-called party of non-voters. You hear about a case of corruption. Maybe you go to the newspapers and become a whistleblower. Or maybe you don't and tell your friends it isn't worthwhile. If you want to change the government by voting, you have to rely on those who count the votes. If you don't vote, you don't vote for a reason. And you have to rely on the information you have about the manipulation of former elections. And you have to assume that the people you receive your information from are trustworthy. Even if you say that the only solution is toppling the government and the only way to do this is to found a terrorist movement, you must undertake your preparations in a trustworthy environment. First, you have to collect evidence that the political system is not to be trusted. You have to inform yourself about how and where to get illegal passports, and that means you have to learn to trust a criminal network and to know whom you can trust in it. You need a secret apartment, you have to know where to get one, and pay in cash for it without looking suspicious. You believe that the lights in the apartment work, and that power grid and water utility will work. You don't even think of it. If you want to hijack an airplane, you trust the schedules, you buy a ticket, you pay for it, and you trust that all this works. You take a taxi to the airport, and if you pay for it, you don't even think about the possibility that the taxi driver says to you, $100,000, please. In short, to make our environment a little bit less trustworthy, you have to have a lot of trust in it. I go to the Einstein Forum. I know where it is. I've been there before, and trust that they would have informed me if they had changed locations. I was invited to give a lecture, and I wrote that I'd write one. I trust that the Einstein Forum will inform me in time if they change their plans. If the Einstein Forum had changed its address, or if they decided against the symposium on trust in favor of some other topic, without letting me know, my confidence in the world would not collapse. But I would be angry, because I have the right to assume this wouldn't happen, and I would be much more careful next time. But you see, this is not the case. I'm here, am Neuen Markt 7, at a symposium on trust, delivering my lecture. For this to happen, I had to trust in many things. The staff of the Einstein Forum, thanks a lot. Potsdam's infrastructure, the technicians who repaired my personal computer when it broke. I was aware of the possibility and made backup copies. All you hear, who by listening attentively to my talk signalize that we have similar expectations of an academic symposium. We do many things every minute to make our environment a trustworthy one. Think of all the things you and others, people you know or you don't know or will never know, are not aware of, because if we were, we couldn't. Because of thinking about this would keep us more than busy. It would just drive us mad. And now think of all the things you and others do not do. And because you and others do not do them, our social environment stays the way it is. Everything you do or do not do is an act of communication. You signalize what others can expect and what they cannot expect. Others respond in turn. This communication is absolutely necessary. It is also absolutely necessary that neither you nor anyone else is aware of it. A trustworthy environment is maintained by permanent, unconscious effort.
Sie sind im D-Radio-Wissen Hörsaal und hören den Literatur- und Sozialwissenschaftler Jan-Philipp Remzmar mit seinem Beitrag zur Tagung On Trust des Einstein-Forums Potsdam am 3. November 2011. Sein Thema: Vertrauen und Misstrauen.
D-Radio-Wissen Hörsaal. Rein in den Elfenbeinturm. Es gilt das gesprochene Wort. In Universitäten, Akademien und Forschungszentren. Die großen Köpfe der Vergangenheit, die besten Hirne der Gegenwart.
Can trust be disappointed? Of course it can. If people's trust is disappointed, they adjust their behavior accordingly. They modify it, albeit slightly, the composition of their environment and signal to others that they've done so. Others may change their way of behavior to accommodate the new environment or come to the conclusion that it doesn't concern them. Either way, such modifications have practical consequences and are acts of communication. It's social evolution. Together we construct a concept of normality, regardless whether we like this idea or not. And this concept of normality is permanently changing and permanently being changed by us. Because we cannot live without trust, we work continuously to keep the world a trustworthy place. To do this, we have to be mistrustful at times, else we'll be permanently disappointed. We have to know what to do or what to do instead, or how to find out what we do if we don't. In the year 1990, I met an elderly lady in a Spanish airport. She was walking around, showing her ticket to everyone, saying, Munich, Munich. She was from East Germany, and she couldn't read or speak or understand English. She had not traveled by airplane before, or not on her own, and didn't know what to do. I explained to her in German, just sit down here, here's your gate, and then you will see the sign boarding. I put it down. And then you go to the desk, and they will help you board the right airplane. She did not understand what a gate or a desk was. Not only that, she didn't seem to understand the words. She couldn't pick out a gate from all the strange things around her. She was in the same situation we would be if a wildness guy said to us, "Look at the tracks of the leopard on the surface of that rock." I assume most of us would say, "Sorry, I don't see them." What did the helpless lady do to get help? She showed her ticket to everyone she met and read the words she could pronounce. Munich, 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 Munich. I found a flight attendant and explained the situation. We both tried to change the lady's environment to make it more familiar, but she had to be guarded. We could only hope that our changes were for the better. To work together in this sense, directly or indirectly, whether in close contact with others or unaware of others' existence, makes us members of a society. It doesn't take much. All we need is a collective feeling of we. That together we represent something we can call us. In working together on and communicating about this collective project, the project that defines our normality, we provide a ceaseless flow of answers to mostly tacit questions. Who am I? Who are you? Who are we? I'm not talking about the big questions asked in historical momentous occasions, as when German demonstrators shouted the slogan, "We are the people, wir sind das Volk." This was, in that moment, a very meaningful slogan. Testifying to its importance was how it could be handled ironically. One demonstrator displayed the sign, "Ich bin Volker." Wir sind das Volk, ich bin Volker, the equivalent of something like I am Pip. We are the people, I am Pip. By contrast, questions that concern trust we do not ask out loud. We feel these questions need no answering, though implicitly we are answering them all the time. These questions lack all pathos and brook not a hint of irony. When we do ask such questions in a melodramatic tremolo, questions like, "Who are we?" it is because the standards for one kind of normality have dissolved and we need reorientation. It's because, in all likelihood, our trust has been shattered. The state of trust is a state of heteronomy. Autonomy makes for contrasts. Whether someone is a heretic, a hero, a prophet, a grouch, he insists on his or her own autonomy. Walter Benjamin was correct when he wrote that the masses admire great criminals as much as they do heroes and martyrs. And when Bertolt Brecht wrote that a nation that doesn't need heroes can count itself lucky, he was also implicitly referring on social trust. Are those who mistrust the idea that we need heroes saying that we are already happy enough in our trust? Or when Susan Nyman insists that we need heroes from time to time, does she imply we are not happy in our trust as we should be? I apologize for this discretion. Trust can be shattered on individual and social levels, and it has been shattered many times through history. None of us today share the beliefs of the Aztecs, even though they thought their beliefs were absolutely necessary for life. Of those today who call themselves religious, very few, I think, would say that calling oneself religious in the 21st century is identical to calling oneself religious in the Middle Ages. And those who do undermine the truth of their assertion by responding to the question. No one living in the Middle Ages would have understood the question, "Are you a religious person?" Not being religious would have been incomprehensible to them. Can trust totally collapse? On an individual level, yes. For a moment, people can think they have fallen out of the state of normality as such out of the world. This is probably not the correct description of their state of mind. They haven't fallen out of the world. They have fallen into a very different part of the world, one part they never wanted to inhabit. Normality has changed in dramatic fashion, and they need time and practice to cope, provided they can learn to cope. They overestimate the aspect of normality that is or seems to be out of point. People have the ability to adapt to many places, even ugly places, just because they live in them and the places are in the world. Many of those who survive will readapt to normality and accept the new environment and its different standards of trust. If they can't, if they are unable to build any kind of environment built on trust, they fall out of each and everything. Their perception of the outside world will collapse. Their perception of their own minds and body will collapse. We have examples for that. And in one way or the other, they will die. Can trust collapse on a social level? Normally it does not. Social trust can undergo transformations, even dramatic ones, but as a rule it doesn't collapse. That's why you can say that society is a kind of continuity and that history and sociology study ongoing developments. This doesn't mean that history and sociology aren't confronted with endings, and you have to describe what ends if you want to describe what elsewhere persists. During the Spanish conquest of the Caribbean, the shock for some of the indigenous population drove them literally to extinction. They were not murdered, at least not directly. Rather, they simply stopped living. They stopped reproducing and killed any infants who were born. Soon, adults began committing suicide. The Spaniards said that the Indian slaves were so lazy that they permitted suicide to work. The early Christians believed the world was going to end 500 years after Christ's crucifixion and be announced by the appearance of the Antichrist. What really happened was starvation, epidemic diseases seemed to confirm their fears. But this did not lead to a collapse of trust. People knew what to do: to go to church, pray, give big donations to monasteries, and even bigger sums upon their death. Archaeologists have observed that more churches were erected in the Byzantine Empire in the decades shortly before 500 AD than during all the years prior. The problem came when the year 500 passed and the end of the world did not come. Everything that had made sense before stopped making sense. The world had gone mad and people had no idea what to do. Some gave up the Christian beliefs and converted to ancient religions. Some burned down the churches and monasteries and killed priests and monks. Others rejected the values of religion and civilization. And there were reports of orgies taking place on cemeteries. Others ran through the streets not knowing what to do. Others were said to have lost the ability of human language, and they barked like dogs instead. A footnote: a woman told that during the bombing of Hamburg, she and her young daughter fled the house. She crossed the street, but told her daughter to stay. Soon after, the house lay in ruins, and the woman found her daughter still standing there, unharmed, but barking. You can interpret the stories told about the last day of the war in and around Berlin in a similar way. Soldiers didn't know where the front was, where the enemy was. They didn't know where to hide. Young people were swearing allegiance to the Führer, but the German Wehrmacht had neither uniforms nor guns. Allied troops reported how disoriented German soldiers went to the prison camps to get arrested. Not only was it better than getting shot, the barbed wire had signalized a world in which life continued. Not the way they had hoped, but in a way they could adopt as a new form of normality. A form of normality in which they could learn what to trust and what to mistrust. Still, it was a radical change. Some had almost reached the point where they no longer knew what to do next. We all know the story of the airplane with a football team on board that crashed in the Andes. The survivors decide to eat the bodies of those who died in the crash. Before they did, each made an oath that, should he die, the others should eat him. This ritual allowed them to break a taboo and redefine the eating of their friends' bodies as a kind of mutual sacrifice. A photograph from the first years of the Soviet Union shows people leaning against a wooden wall before a kind of coffer, presenting heads and other human body parts. It appears they are presenting the body parts in public, and the camera that took the picture was merely recording the moment. Are the bodies for sale? Whatever the people are doing, they are not doing it in secret. In their hunger and despair, they overcame the taboo of cannibalism and maybe the taboo of murder as well. What is more, they are showing that they or others overcame the taboo and that they or others are saving their lives by doing so. Through this gesture of public display, the people in the photograph are creating a new framework of normality, of how life is. And this framework will affect everyone who comes in contact with it, even the youngest members of the community. Maybe it signalizes a new economic order. This too could be called trust. Everyone understood that the extreme cold might kill them, just as surely hungry people might kill them and eat them and think it's normal. For people in this community, this is how social life was and will go on. At least, the impromptu marketplace was selling body parts at prices people could afford. You see, trust, in the way I use the term, has nothing to do with whether something is good or cozy. Trust doesn't make life easy. It is something without which social life is impossible. And social life is possible under very ugly and excruciating circumstances, as we all know from history. Nevertheless, we have difficulties. We experience a certain disgust whenever the words trust and violence appear too close together. So you see, I have to come to the word violence. I can't escape. Some of us seem to believe that if trust binds people on a deep level, then violence must somehow be a foreign antithetical substance. Those that feel this way forget that violence, and not only individual violence, has been part of every society ever known. Still, the role played by violence in society can vary greatly. No society forbids or permits violent actions in general. Every society forbids, permits, or mandates violent actions in different ways. The problem is never violence as such, but violence committed in the wrong place, at the wrong time, or on the wrong person. And ignoring a society's lines between permitted, forbidden, and mandated violence can bring severe consequences. It makes little difference how violent societies seem to us or how strange the permitted or forbidden or mandated forms of violence might be to us. Every society uses violence, and every society uses violence in different ways. And every society sees its own distinctions between forms of violence as normal or natural and those of other societies as strange, ridiculous, or barbaric. Often we see the distinctions made by other societies and other ages as a tantamount to making no distinctions whatsoever. This is not the case, but it shows how deeply our sense of what counts as a distinction is rooted in cultural self-understanding. There have been many moments in history in which different ideas of violence have run up against each other, causing confusion or even conflict. One side says, so, they think they can permit all forms of violence against us. Well, to maintain our way of life, we will permit all forms of violence against them. The process by which a society distinguishes between forms of violence has three aspects: social interactions, the role of violence in government institutions, and collective beliefs. Every society differentiates between different forms of violence and different places of violence. Once the lines have been drawn, transgressions become a problem. The reason is that violence plays a very important part in how a society's sense of trust generates social cohesion. Violence requires a specific form of legitimation. Either you are forbidden from acting violently, or you are required to act violently, or you are permitted to act violently, but need not. The cultural formation known as modernity, a fuzzy concept again, and by modernity I mean a transatlantic Western European and Central European culture born of the religious and political crisis in the 16th and 17th centuries. Others have a different time frame for that. This cultural formation we call modernity, the cultural formation in which we now live requires something else of violence. Not only must we ask whether violence is carried out in the proper place against the proper person and by the proper person, we must also ask, is violence truly necessary? Unlike all other cultural formations, past or present, modernity has an idea of itself as progressing toward ever less violence. The violence modernity needs, it justifies as need for now, or as a necessary way to prevent greater outbreaks of violence, or necessary to pave the way for a future with less violence. Regardless of the war, regardless of the domestic and foreign policy in place, the use of violence has to be legitimized this way. Whatever doesn't fit in this framework of legitimation is not only forbidden, it has to be accounted for. What went wrong? How could this happen? Historians, sociologists, psychologists, and psychiatrists have to perform explanatory work. By doing so, they build trust in modernity. Of course, something can occur in modernity that does not have a place in modern culture. But if and when that happens, someone must explain why it happened and why we can still trust in modernity. Doing so is hard work, but it keeps many academics busy. And for heaven's sake, somehow it even works. There is no form of accepted violence in our daily lives. At least in Europe, none of us wear a sword or a dagger or a gun, and if we do, there'll be severe consequences. Countries that have carried out death penalties for centuries have since abolished the practice, and most countries that have not abolished the practice do not execute people in public and use form of executions they believe to be less painful than those used at former times. Believe is the operative word here. And they justify the practice by claiming that capital punishment is the best way to deter others from committing similar crimes. There are still wars in modernity, but the way they are legitimized has changed. The First World War was the first war referred to as the war to end all wars. Other wars were justified to prevent more severe violence. The war Nazi Germany waged in Eastern Europe was intentionally designed to break the rules of modernity and demolish modern civilization. Afterward, people asked, how could this happen? How could this outbreak of violence happen in a civilized country? About the Soviet Union, they asked, how could a country pave its way to modernity with millions of murdered and tortured people and create a state driven by suspicion, paranoia, and show trials? About the United States, people asked, how could a state that waged war against two barbaric regimes, Germany and Japan, use a weapon that killed tens of thousands in an instant, and many more in the years after? A weapon that was not loved because it promised to be the weapon to all, end all wars, so it now seems to have functioned this way, but because it created a moment of delirium amongst its leading politicians who promised themselves greater and more effective wars. The question, how could that happen, can be answered easily. Just tell the story. Historians did and shall continue to do so. It's no mystery, it's just history. It's putting down in detail what happened. Historians tell the story, there's no hidden agenda, there's nothing behind the scenes. You may ask why modernity's idea of itself did not collapse when modernity partially collapsed. By collapsed, I mean transformed itself in a way so as to abandon the framework of normality and trust that characterizes modernity. That framework of normality and trust said that violence must be legitimized, that violence in society, both legitimate and illegitimate, must diminish over time and so on. It didn't collapse that way. It didn't undergo a transformation, which all this left behind. History shows us that this was possible and will continue to be possible, outbreaks of violence. Even in countries that have experienced decades of civil war, there's still social trust. People know what to do. Follow the vote of the right party, or if they don't have the choice, they toe the party line of the local government, of the neighbors. They fight, they try to survive, to get the rewards they have been promised to get, and if they don't get them, they try to get them if they can. Trust in Nazi Germany also meant knowing what to do, being part of the Volksgemeinschaft and behaving accordingly. Of course, not being a Jew was nothing you could choose. As long as you had the choice, you could emigrate, but you could never be sure whether you would be successful in that or not. And for a lot of Jews, the space of acting was so narrow that it was psychologically easier to deny the political reality. It was also a matter of imaginative capacity. Could the transformation of civilization be that deep, that radical? Trust in the Stalinist Soviet Union consisted in knowing that everyone, even members of the old Leninist guard and the Politburo, could be politically persecuted. Sometimes the regime's lies helped make this truth more bearable. At any rate, though, there was always a way to be on the safe side, or to believe, at least, you were on the safe side. And that was to denounce others faster than they could denounce you. Sometimes this way was a very effective way of climbing the career ladder, both in politics and business. Even a violent and evil environment offers ways of acting and provides answers to the question of what to do. And what did we, children of modernity, do after modernity partially collapsed? We acted as if it didn't. This was part denial, part mystification, and part politics. And it was the explicit or inexplicit, the conscious or unconscious will to reclaim and perpetuate the previous standard of modernity and social trust. You see, trust is a fuzzy concept, but not that fuzzy. Thank you.
Sie hörten den Philologen, Mäzen und Publizisten Jan-Philipp Remzma mit seinem Vortrag Trust and Mistrust, also Vertrauen und Misstrauen. Remzma schloss mit diesem Vortrag den ersten Tag der Tagung on Trust des Einstein-Forums ab, die am 3. und 4. November dieses Jahres in Potsdam stattgefunden hat und deren Vorträge wir derzeit als Reihe senden.
D-Radio Wissen. D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.